As to the reasons for persecuting witches in a Christian society, because beyond the first few pages, she discovered that the book had been hollowed out to create a cavity. Inside were a number of sheets of paper folded and tied with a length of twine. She undid the knot and opened the pages. The first was a letter, very old, dated 1586, and written in such faded, scratchy writing that she did not even attempt at once to read it. The other pages were drawings, designs for the house, Lucy realised, remembering that Edward had said that it was built during the reign of Elizabeth. Lucy was thrilled, not because she had any particular interest in architecture, but because she knew that Edward would be delighted, and anything that earned his pleasure made her glad. As she studied the designs, though, she noticed in them something unusual. There were sketches of what the house would look like, the twin gables, the chimneys, the rooms that Lucy now recognised. But there was an additional layer, inscribed on the most transparent of paper, which overlaid the first. When Lucy put it on top and lined them up, she noticed that it showed two additional rooms, both of them tiny, far too small to be bedrooms, or even antechambers. Neither of them had she come across in her explorations. She frowned, lifting the fine paper and then replacing it in a slightly different position, trying to get a sense of what the rooms might be. The boat had come to rest by now in a small inlet, its prow nosing into the grassy riverbank, and Lucy folded the floor plan away, taking up the letter in the hope that it might shed some light. It was written by a man called Nicholas Owen, the name vaguely familiar to Lucy, perhaps from something she had read. The writing was in an elaborate historical style, but she managed to pick out some of the words. Protect. Priests. Holes. Lucy gasped as she realised what the plan revealed. She had read, of course, about the measures taken against Catholic priests after Queen Elizabeth ascended to the throne. She knew that a great many houses had a secret chamber built into them, whether within the walls or beneath the floors, in order to shelter persecuted priests. But to think that there were one, maybe even two, here at Birchwood Manor was beyond thrilling. Even more exciting, it seemed probable to Lucy that Edward had no idea about the secret hideaways, for surely if he had, it would have been one of the first things he'd have told them all. Which meant that she was going to be able to share something wonderful with him about the house that he loved. Edward's truthful house had a secret. Lucy couldn't get the boat back to the jetty quickly enough. She tied it up, gathered her books beneath her arm, and started running towards the house. Although she did not often give herself over to glee, and rarely to singing, she found herself humming one of Mother's favourite dance tunes as she ran and took it up with gusto. Arriving back at the house, she went first to the Mulberry Room, for although Edward did not like to be disturbed while he was working, she was certain that under these circumstances, he would make an exception. The room was unattended. A silk cloth had been draped over the canvas, and Lucy vacillated briefly before deciding that she didn't have the time to spare. Next, she looked upstairs in the bedroom that he had chosen for himself, overlooking the woods, but there was no sign. She ran along the hallways, peeking into each room that she passed, even braving an eyeful of Claire's longing simper when she checked inside the front sitting room. In the kitchen, she found Emma preparing the evening meal. But when asked after Edward's whereabouts, the maid only lifted her left shoulder before launching into an admonishment of Thurston, who had developed a most unpleasant habit of climbing onto the rooftop of a morning and using the Napoleonic war rifle he had brought with him from London to take aim at the birds. "It's a terrible racket," said Emma. "I mean, maybe if he stood a chance of bringing down a duck that I could roast. But his aim's no good. And anyway, he takes shot at the smaller birds that don't make for proper eating." It was a familiar lament, and Edward had asked Thurston many times to stop, warning him that he might shoot one of the farmers by mistake and find himself up on charges of murder. "I'll tell Edward as soon as I find him," said Lucy in her best attempt at placation. They had formed a bond of sorts, she and Emma, during the course of the fortnight. Lucy had a feeling that the maid had her pegged as the only other normal person in the house. As the artists and models flew in and out of the kitchen in loose costumes and with paintbrushes tucked behind their ears, Emma seemed to save all of her head shakings and tut-tuts for Lucy, as if they were kindred spirits caught in a current of madness. Today, though, Lucy could spare Emma only the minimum of attention. "I promise I'll tell him," she said again, already on the move, skipping sideways and through the front door into the garden. But Edward was in none of his favourite outdoor places, and Lucy was almost dying with frustration when she finally spotted Lily Millington about to leave the garden by the front gate that opened out onto the lane. The sun was catching her hair so that it looked ablaze.
"Lily!"
she called. At first, the model did not appear to hear her, so she called again, louder.
"Lily!"
Lily Millington turned around, and perhaps she had been far away in her thoughts, for her expression was as if she had been surprised by the sound of her own name.
"Why, hello there, Lucy," she said with a smile. "I'm looking for Edward. Have you seen him anywhere?"
"He went to the woods. He said he'd gone to see a man about a dog."
"Are you meeting him there?"
Lucy had noticed that Lily Millington was wearing walking boots and carrying a bag over her shoulder.
"No, I'm off to the village to see a man about a stamp."
She held up an addressed envelope. "Fancy a walk?" With no chance to tell Edward what she had discovered about the house, Lucy decided that it was better to fill her afternoon with an activity than to wait around, cooling her heels. They strolled along the laneway, past a church on the corner, and into the village. The small post office was next door to a public house called the Swan.
"I'll wait here," said Lucy, who had seen an interesting stone structure over where the roads crossed and wanted to have a closer look.
Lily did not take long, emerging from the post office with her letter in hand, a stamp now affixed on its corner. Whatever she was posting was heavy enough to require a two-penny blue, Lucy noted, and was addressed to someone in London. Lily slipped it into the postbox, and they started the short walk back to Birchwood Manor. Lucy did not have the art of small talk, not like Claire and Mother, and she wondered what one was supposed to say to fill the silence in such a situation. Not that she believed silence needed filling, not generally. Only that something about Lily Millington made Lucy wish to appear more grown up, more clever, more significant than usual. For some reason that would require unpicking later, it seemed important that she should appear as more than simply Edward's little sister.
"Lovely weather," she said, causing herself to cringe into her collar.
"Enjoy it while it lasts," said Lily. "It's going to storm tonight."
"How can you tell?"
"I have a rare and wondrous ability to read the future." Lucy glanced at her. Lily Millington smiled. "I have an interest in synoptic charts and chanced to see one in a copy of the Times on the postmaster's desk."
"You know about weather forecasting?"
"Only what I've heard from Robert Fitzroy."
"You've met Robert Fitzroy?"
"Friend to Charles Darwin, commander of the HMS Beagle, inventor of barometers, and the first ever meteorological statist to the Board of Trade. I've heard him speak. He's the friend of a friend. He's working on a book about weather that sounds very promising."
"Did you ever hear him speak about the sinking of the Royal Charter and the creation of the Fitzroy Storm Barometer?"
"Of course. It's quite remarkable." As Lily Millington launched into a fascinating account of the theory behind Fitzroy's forecasting charts and the science behind his storm glasses, Lucy listened with an avid 97% of her attention. With the other 3%, she wondered whether it was too much to hope that when Edward lost interest in this model, Lucy would be able to keep Lily Millington for herself. Lily Millington had been right about the storm. The stretch of perfect summer weather came to an abrupt end late that afternoon, sunlight disappearing from the sky as suddenly and surely as if someone had blown out the flame within the world's lamp. Lucy didn't notice, though, for she was already sitting in the dark, secreted within a hidden cavity beneath the skin of Edward's house.
She had spent a most exciting afternoon. After they arrived back from the post office, Lily Millington had decided to walk down to the woods to rendezvous with Edward. Emma, still busy in the kitchen, was happy to report that Thurston, Claire, Adele and Felix had taken a picnic tea to share by the river and were planning afterwards to swim, and that she herself was ahead of schedule with the dinner preparations and, if there was nothing that Lucy was wanting, was going to pop back home for an hour or so to put my feet up. With the house to herself, Lucy knew precisely how she was going to spend her time. The initial thrill of discovery had dissipated, and in its wake lay the realization that it would be a terrible folly to rush now into telling Edward about the priest holes. The floor plans were centuries old. It was entirely possible that the chambers had been sealed up years before, or else that the plans, though mooted, had never been put into place. How embarrassing it would be to make a big announcement only to discover herself in error. Lucy did not like making errors. Far better to investigate the secret hideaways herself first. Once Emma had been sent packing and Lily Millington was little more than a flame-coloured speck on the far side of the meadow, Lucy pulled out the floor plans. The first chamber appeared to form part of the main staircase, which seemed so unlikely that Lucy thought initially that she must have been reading the plan incorrectly. She had climbed the staircase at least 100 times by now and sat to read more than once on the elegant bentwood chair by the window. Aside from a pleasant warmth where the stairs made their turn, she hadn't noticed anything out of the ordinary. Only when she fetched the magnifying glass from the cedar desk in the library and began to decipher the letter did Lucy find the instruction that she'd been lacking. There was a trick step, the letter said. The first rise after the landing had been constructed so that it tilted, when triggered properly, to reveal the entrance to a small secret chamber. But be warned, continued the letter, for the design of the trapdoor was such that in order to remain discreet, the hidden mechanism could only be triggered from the outside. It was like something out of one of those newspaper serials for schoolboys, and Lucy ran to investigate, pushing aside the chair as she knelt on the floor. There was nothing visible to suggest that the staircase was anything other than it appeared, and she frowned again at the letter. She studied the description, which included a sketch of a spring-operated latch, and then smiled to herself. Pressing each corner of the wooden rise in turn, she held her breath until finally she heard a small click and noticed that the panel had jutted out of position slightly at the base. She slipped her fingers into the newly revealed crack and lifted, sliding it into a recess beneath the next step. A slim, sly opening was revealed, large enough just to fit a man carrying no extra weight. Lucy only considered for a split second before slipping down into the cavity. The space was tight, not high enough for her to sit unless her head was bent so far forwards that her chin was touching her chest, and so she lay down flat. The air inside was stale and close. The floor was warm to the touch, and Lucy supposed that the chimney from the kitchen must run at an angle beneath it. She lay very still, listening. It was startlingly quiet. She shuffled sideways and pressed her ear against the wall. Dead wooden silence. Solid, as if there were layers of bricks on the other side. Lucy tried to envisage the design of the house, wondering how that could be. As she did, the realization that she was lying in a secret chamber designed to keep a man concealed from enemies bent on his destruction, with a trap door that might ease closed at any moment, leaving her alone in a pitch-black space, drowning in thick, broiling air, no one aware of what she'd found and where she'd gone, began to push in on her from all sides. She felt a sudden panic, constricting her lungs, her breaths becoming short and loud, and she scrabbled into a crouched position as quickly as she could, hitting her head on the ceiling of the chamber in her rush to get free. The second hideaway was in the hallway, and that was where Lucy was now. It was a very different prospect, a concealment within the wainscoting, tucked behind an ingenious recessed sliding panel that could be opened, thankfully, from inside or out. The space inside was not large, but it had a different feeling entirely from the stairwell chamber. There was something comforting about this hiding place. It was not truly dark, for one thing, Lucy noticed, and the chamber's panel was thin enough that she could hear through it. She had heard when the others returned from the river, laughing as they chased one another through the halls. She had heard, too, when Felix and Adele had their hissed spat about a joke, according to him, that had gone wrong, according to her. And she had heard the first great clap of thunder that rolled up the river and seized the house. Lucy had just decided to climb out of the space and had her ear pressed close against the panel to make sure there was no one in the hallway to see her appear and discover her secret when she picked out Edward's footfalls approaching. She considered emerging into his path and surprising him and was wondering whether it might not be the perfect way to reveal to him the priest holes when she heard him say, "Come here, wife." Lucy stopped still, her hands on the panel. "What is it, husband?" Lily Millington's voice. "Closer than that. Like this." Lucy leaned against the panel, listening. They did not say anything else, but Edward laughed softly. There was an edge of surprise to it, as if he had just been told something unexpected but pleasing, and someone inhaled sharply. And then... nothing. Inside the hiding place, Lucy realized that she was holding her breath. She released it. 2 seconds later, everything went black, and a great rumble of thunder shook the house and the ancient earth beneath it. The others were already in the dining room by the time Lucy arrived. A candelabrum stood in the middle of the unlaid table, 9 long white tapers smoking towards the ceiling. The wind had picked up outside, and although it was summer, the night was cool. Someone had lit a small fire, which flickered and popped in the grate, and Edward and Lily Millington were sitting by it. Lucy went to the mahogany armchair on the other side of the room. "Well, I'm not frightened of ghosts," Adele was saying, perched beside Claire on the tapestry-covered sofa that ran against the longer wall. It was a topic to which the pair returned frequently. "They are simply poor trapped souls seeking to be set free. I think we should try some table turning. See if we can invite one in to join us."
"Do you have a talking board with you?"
Adele frowned. "I don't." Edward had his head bowed close to Lily Millington's, and Lucy could see his lips moving as he spoke. Lily Millington was nodding every so often, and as Lucy watched, she reached up to run her fingertips along the edge of his blue silk neck scarf.
"I'm famished," said Thurston, pacing behind the table. "Where on earth is that girl?"
Lucy remembered Emma saying that she was going home to put her feet up. "She planned to be back in time to serve the dinner."
"Then she's late."
"Perhaps the storm has waylaid her."
Felix, standing by the rain-streaked window, craned to see something up on the eave.
"It's bucketing down. The drain's already overflowing."
Lucy glanced again at Edward and Lily. It was possible, of course, that she had misheard them in the hallway. More likely, though, that she had simply misunderstood. The Magenta Brotherhood were always adopting different pet names for one another. For a time, Adele had been Puss, because Edward painted her in a scene with a tiger, and Claire had once been Rosie, after Thurston made an unfortunate miscalculation with his pigments and gave her too much flush in her cheeks. "Every self-respecting house has a ghost these days." Claire shrugged.
"I haven't seen one yet."
"Seen?" said Adele. "Don't be so old-fashioned. Everybody nowadays knows that ghosts are invisible."
"Or translucent." Felix turned back to face them. "As in Mumler's photographs."
"And A Christmas Carol." Lucy remembered the description of Marley's ghost dragging his chains and padlocks, the way Scrooge could look right through him to the buttons on the back of his coat.
"I suppose we could make a talking board of our own," said Claire. "It's only some letters and a glass."
"That's true. The ghost will do the rest."
"No," said Edward, looking up. "No talking board, no table turning."
"Oh, Edward!" Claire pouted. "Don't spoil the fun! Aren't you curious? You might have your very own ghost here at Birchwood.
just waiting to introduce herself.
I don't need a talking board to tell me that there's a presence in this house.
Whatever do you mean? Said Adele.
Yes, Edward.
This was Claire standing now.
What do you mean?
For a split second, Lucy thought that he was going to tell them all about the night of the following, and her eyes pricked with tears. It was their secret. But he didn't. He told them instead the story of the Eldritch children, the folk tale about the three mysterious children who, according to legend, had long ago appeared in the field by the woods, confusing local farmers with their skin that glowed and their long, gleaming hair. Lucy could have laughed with relief. The others listened spellbound as Edward brought the tale to life. The village people, so eager to blame the strange young outsiders when crops failed and the family members sickened. The kind old couple, who took the children under their wing, moving them to the safety of a small stone croft within a bend of the river. The angry group that stormed the site one night, their torches lit and their bellies filled with fire. And then, at the last moment, the otherworldly sound of the horn on the wind and the appearance of the luminous fairy queen.
That's what I'm painting for the exhibition. The Fairy Queen, protector of the realm, rescuer of the children. At the very point where the doorway between worlds can be opened.
He smiled at Lily Millington.
I've wanted to paint her forever. And now that I've finally found her, I can.
There was much enthusiasm from the others, and then Felix said,
You've just given me the most wonderful idea. It has become abundantly clear over the past fortnight that the day will never come when a breeze does not blow down that river of yours.
As if to underline the point, a great gust rattled the glass window panes in their frames and made the fire hiss in the grate.
I am ready to retire the Lady of Shalott for a time. I say, instead, that we stage a photograph, all of us, just as Edward described, the Fairy Queen and her three children.
But that's four characters, and there are only three models here, said Claire. Are you suggesting that Edward should dress in the part of one?
Or Thurston? Said Adele with a laugh.
I mean Lucy, of course.
But Lucy isn't a model.
She's even better. She's a genuine child.
Lucy felt her cheeks heat at the prospect that she might be asked to serve as a model in one of Felix's photographs. He had taken images of all of them over the past fortnight, but only for practice and not as proper works of art, not for possible display in Mr. Ruskin's exhibition. Claire said something, but it was drowned out by a crack of thunder so loud that the house shook. And then...
That settles it, said Felix,
and talk fell to costumes. How garlands might be made, whether gauze would be used to help create the effect that the Eldritch children were glowing. Thurston moved closer to Edward.
You said that there were ghosts here at Birchwood Manor, but then told us a story about a fairy queen rescuing her children.
I did not say that there were ghosts. I said there was a presence, and I haven't reached the end of the story yet.
Go on, then.
When the Queen arrived to take her children back to Fairyland, she was so grateful to the old human couple who had protected them that she cast an enchantment across their home and lands. To this day, it is said that a light can be glimpsed at times in the uppermost window of any house that stands upon this plot of land. The presence of the Eldritch people.
A light in the window.
That's what they say.
Have you ever seen it?
Edward did not answer at once, and Lucy knew then that he was thinking of the night of the following. Thurston pressed.
You wrote to me when you purchased Birchwood Manor and told me that the house had called to you for a long time. I did not know then what you meant, and you said that you would tell me the next time we met. By then, though... You had other things on your mind.
His glance swept sideways, briefly to land on Lily Millington, who met it directly and without even the glimmer of a smile.
Is it true, Edward?
said Claire from the other side of the table.
Did you see a light in the window?
Edward did not answer at once, and Lucy could have kicked Claire hard in the shins for putting him on the spot like that. She could still remember how frightened he'd been after the night of the following, his pale skin and the dark shadows beneath his eyes after standing watch all night in the attic, waiting to see whether whatever had followed him would find him in the house. She tried to catch his eye, to signal to him that she understood, but he was focused on Lily Millington. He was reading her face, as if they were the only two people in the room.
"Should I tell them?" he said.
Lily Millington took his hand.
"Only if you wish to."
With a slight nod and a smile that made him look younger, he began to speak.
"Many years ago, when I was a boy, I ventured into these woods alone at night, and something terrifying."
Suddenly, there came a loud rapping on the front door. Claire squealed and clutched Adele.
"It must be Emma," said Felix.
"About time," said Thurston.
"But why would Emma knock?" asked Lily Millington. "She never has before." The knock came again, louder this time, and then the hinge creaking sound of the front door being pushed wide open. In the flickering glow of the candles, they all glanced at one another, waiting as footsteps sounded down the passage. As a flash of lightning silvered the outside world, the door flew open and a gust of wind shot through, throwing shadows with teeth along the walls. There, on the threshold, in the green velvet dress that she had worn to have her portrait painted, stood Edward's fiancée.
"So sorry I'm late," Fanny said as thunder growled past her. "I hope I haven't missed anything important."
Chapter 26. Fanny stepped into the room and began to remove her travelling gloves, and with her came an invisible but potent change. Lucy wasn't sure how exactly, but after a stretched moment of suspension, the others all fell at once into action, as if their movements had been choreographed beforehand. Claire and Adele became emphatically involved in a close conversation on the sofa, each keeping one ear carefully tuned to happenings beyond their coterie. Felix returned his attention to the downpipe outside the window. Thurston spoke loudly and generally to the room about his hunger and the difficulty in finding good help these days. And Lily Millington excused herself, muttering something about cheese and bread for supper as she left the room. Edward, meanwhile, went to Fanny and began to help her with her dripping coat. But Lucy had not received the cue. Instead, she sat lumpen on the armchair, looking left and right for someone to whom she could attach herself. Finding no relief, she stood awkwardly and made a slow, blinkered walk towards the door, easing past Fanny, who was saying,
"A glass of wine, Edward. Red wine. The journey from London was excruciating."
Lucy found herself heading towards the kitchen. Lily Millington was at Emma's large wooden table cutting slices from a wheel of cheddar. She looked up as Lucy appeared at the doorway.
"Hungry?"
Lucy realised that she was hungry. With all of the excitement of the day, the finding of the floor plans, the hunt for Edward, the discovery of the priest holes, she had forgotten all about tea. Now she took up the serrated bread knife and started slicing thick slabs from the loaf. Lily had lighted the tallow lamp that Emma preferred to work by, and the greasy beef smell permeated the room. It was not a pleasant odour, but its familiarity on such a night, as the rain continued in sheets outside and dynamics shifted slyly inside, was welcome, and Lucy experienced an unexpected pang of nostalgia. She felt very young suddenly and longed for nothing more than to be a small child again, for whom everything was black and white and whose bed was even now being prepared by Nanny, a brass warming pan slipped beneath the covers to shoo away the cold and the damp.
"Do you want to see a trick?"
Lily Millington did not pause in her cheese slicing task, and Lucy was so far away with her thoughts that she wondered if she might have misheard. Lily Millington looked up at her then, and seemed to stare. She reached across the table, a slight quizzical frown on her brow, and with her outstretched fingers took something gently from behind Lucy's ear.
She opened her hand, and a silver coin lay in her palm.
A shilling, lucky me. I'll have to check you more often.
How did you do that?
Magic.
Lucy's fingers went quickly to the skin behind her ear.
Will you tell me how to do it?
I'll think about it. Lily took a few slices of bread from Lucy's board.
Sandwich?
She'd made one for herself too, and now went to sit on the end of the table nearest the front window.
Cook's prerogative,
she said, when she noticed Lucy watching.
I see no reason that we should rush back. The others have enough to keep them occupied. They'll not starve.
Thurston said that he was famished.
Did he?
Lily Millington took a deep, satisfied bite of her sandwich. Lucy went to sit beside Lily Millington on the table end. Outside, through the window, a rift between clouds revealed a small patch of clear sky above the storm. Within it, a few faraway stars twinkled.
Do you think that we will ever know how the stars were formed?
Asked Lucy.
Yes. Really? How can you be so sure?
Because a chemist called Bunsen and a physicist named Kirchhoff have worked out how to use the spectrum produced when sunlight passes through a prism to name the chemicals present in the sun.
And the stars?
They say that it follows. Lily Millington was also staring up at the distant sky now, her profile illuminated by the hazy light of the tallow lamp. My father used to tell me that I was born under a lucky star.
A lucky star?
An old sailor's superstition.
Your father was a sailor?
He was a clockmaker, once upon a time. A very good one. He used to repair the collection of a retired sea captain out in Greenwich, and it was there that his mind was filled with seafaring superstitions. It was in Greenwich that I first looked through a telescope.
What did you see?
I was very fortunate, for Neptune had just been found, a planet both new and ancient at once. Lucy wished that her father had been a clockmaker who had taken her with him to the Royal Observatory.
My father died when I was only a child. He had a run-in with a carriage.
Lily Millington turned and smiled at her. Then let us hope that we have better luck than they did. She inclined her head towards the table. In the meantime, I suppose it's time to feed the others. As Lucy finished her sandwich, Lily Millington assembled the rest of the bread and cheese and arranged the supper on a porcelain serving plate. Yes, Lily Millington was different from the models who had come before her, those pretty faces who reminded Lucy of the leaves that fell from the towering lime trees in autumn, the lushest of green in summer, but lasting only one season before they fell clean away, replaced the following year by a fresh new crop. Lily Millington knew about science and had seen the planet of Neptune through a telescope, and there was something inside her that came out in Edward's paintings. Something that had made him tell her about the night of the following. Lucy had a feeling she should hate Lily Millington for that, but she didn't.
Where did you learn to do magic?
She asked. I learned from a French street performer in Covent Garden.
You did not?
I did.
As a child?
A very young child.
What were you doing in Covent Garden?
Picking pockets, mostly. Lucy knew then that Lily Millington was teasing. Edward did that too, when he wanted to end a conversation. As she finished her sandwich, she noticed that the clouds had closed over the gap already and the stars had disappeared. Edward was just leaving when they arrived back at the dining room, a candle in one hand and Fanny leaning hard against his other side. Miss Brown is tired after the day's travel, he said with careful politeness. I'm going to show her to bed. Of course, said Lily Millington. I'll make sure to save you some supper.
I know you didn't mean it, Edward,
Fanny was saying as they made their way slowly along the hallway, her voice more slurred than usual.
I haven't told a soul. You were just confused. It's normal before a wedding.
Shh, there now. Edward helped her begin up the stairs. We'll talk about it tomorrow.
Lucy did not return to the dining room. Instead, she watched them disappear, and when she considered it safe to do so, started up the stairs herself. Edward, she noticed, had taken Fanny into the room beside her own. It was small but pretty, with a four-poster bed and a walnut dressing table under the window. All was quiet until Lucy heard Fanny notice that the window faced east towards the village churchyard.
It's just a different type of sleep, Lucy could hear Edward saying. Nothing more than that, just the long sleep of the dead.
But Edward!
Her voice carried through the open door and down the hall.
It is bad luck to sleep with one's feet facing the dead.
Whatever Edward said by reply, he said it too softly to be heard, for the next words came again from Fanny.
Is your room close by? I shall be frightened otherwise.
Lucy changed into her nightgown and went to stand by her own window. The clematis creeper that grew hungrily along the stone wall of the house had woven its way into the room, and a sprig of flowers sat upon the damp sill. Lucy picked them one by one, sprinkling the petals over the edge and watching them fall like snow. She was wondering about Fanny on the other side of the wall when she heard Edward's voice on the lawn below.
I understand that I have you to thank for this.
Careful to stay out of sight, Lucy craned to see who else was there. Thurston. The rain had stopped and the chill in the air had lifted. A swollen moon had emerged in the clearing sky, brighter, it seemed, for the preceding darkness, and Lucy could see both men standing near the wisteria arbour that ran towards the orchard.
She says that you wrote and told her where to find me.
Thurston had a cigarette between his lips and was holding his Napoleonic war rifle, taking careless aim at imagined adversaries in the chestnut tree behind the house. Now he let its trigger guard roll around his finger like a pantomime villain and held his arms out to the side.
Not at all. I wrote to suggest an appointment, and when we met, I told her where to find you. You're a bastard, Thurston. What else could I do? The poor girl threw herself upon my mercy. Your mercy? You're enjoying this. Edward, you wound me. I'm simply being a friend. She begged me to help you see things clearly. She said that you'd lost your mind and behaved most improperly. I spoke with her. I wrote to her too, explaining everything. Everything? I highly doubt that. I don't believe it, she kept saying. Does he not know who my father is, what he'll do to him? What this would do to me? And then, why would he do it? What reason could he possibly have for breaking his promise?
Thurston laughed.
No, I don't think you explained everything, my dear friend. I told her what she needed to know, without hurting her more than was necessary.
Edward's voice was low, furious.
Well, whatever it was you did write, it is little more than a pile of ash in her father's fireplace now. She refused to accept it. She told me that she needed to see you herself to put things right. Who was I to refuse? You should be thanking me. It's no secret that your family needs what Fanny offers.
His lips curled into an unkind smile.
Those poor sisters of yours haven't much hope otherwise. My sisters are none of your concern. I wish you'd tell that to Claire. She goes to such great lengths to make herself my concern. I've a good mind to give her what she needs. She's going to spoil my painting with her damn longing otherwise. I'm more than happy to look after Lily too, once you and Fanny repair your differences.
The arbour was in the way, so Lucy didn't see the first punch thrown.
She only saw Thurston staggering backwards onto the lawn, his hand on his jaw and a half-smile of surprise on his face.
"Only trying to help, Radcliffe. Fanny might be a bore, but she'll give you a home and allow you to paint. Never know, with time and a bit of luck, she might even learn to turn a blind eye."
Lucy lay in bed afterwards ruminating. The fight between Edward and Thurston had not lasted long, and when it was over, they had gone their separate ways. Lucy had left the window and slid beneath the cool bed covers. She'd always enjoyed being alone, but now, as she registered a gnawing sensation deep within her stomach, she realised that she felt lonely. More than lonely. She felt uncertain, which was infinitely worse. The small bronze clock on Lucy's bedside table said that it was 5 minutes after midnight, which meant that she had been lying in bed waiting for sleep to claim her for over an hour. The house was motionless. The woolly weather outside had calmed. A few night birds had emerged from their hiding spots to perch upon the branches of the moonlit chestnut tree. Lucy could hear them now clearing their throats. Why, she wondered, did the minutes stretch and the hours become interminable when it was dark? She sat up. She was wide awake, and there was no point in pretending otherwise. Her mind was too busy to sleep. She wanted to understand what was going on. Edward had said that Fanny Brown would not be coming to Birchwood Manor, and yet here she was. Everyone else seemed to know enough to be behaving strangely. Thurston and Edward had even had a fight beneath Lucy's window. When she was a little girl and her racing thoughts had refused to let her sleep, it was always Edward to whom Lucy had gone. He would tell her a story and answer any question she had. He would calm her down and usually make her laugh. She always felt better when she left him than she had when she'd arrived. Lucy decided to go and see if he was still awake. It was late, but Edward wouldn't mind. He was a night owl, often working in his studio until long after midnight, the candles burning down towards the necks of the old green bottles that he collected. She crept into the hallway but saw no light coming from beneath any of the bedroom doors. Lucy stood very still, straining to hear. As she listened, a faint noise came from downstairs, the soft, brief scrape of a chair leg moving against the wooden floor. Lucy smiled to herself. Of course, he would be in the mulberry room with his paints and easel. She might have guessed. Edward always said that painting helped to clear his mind, that without it his thoughts would drive him mad. Lucy tiptoed down the stairs, past the platform that masked the secret chamber, all the way to the ground floor. As she had expected, a faint flicker of candlelight emanated from the room at the end of the hallway. The door stood slightly ajar, and Lucy hesitated when she reached it. Edward did not like to be disturbed when he was working. But surely tonight, after what had happened with Thurston, he would be just as glad for company as she. Carefully, Lucy prodded the door, just enough that she could poke her head in to see whether he was there. She saw his painting first. Lily Millington's face, stunning, regal, otherworldly, stared back at her, red hair flaming behind. Lily Millington, the Fairy Queen, was luminous. Lucy noticed then the gem at the hollow of Lily's neck, the same gem that she'd spied when she sneaked an illicit peek at Edward's sketchbook, now depicted in colour. Bright, iridescent blue. As soon as she saw the startling shade, she knew what it was, for Lucy had heard much about the Radcliffe blue pendant, even though she'd never seen it in real life. And she wasn't seeing it in real life now, she reminded herself, only Edward's imagined rendering of it, a talisman at his fairy queen's throat. There was a noise then from inside the room, and Lucy peeked around the edge of the door. She was about to call out to let Edward know that she was there when she saw him on the settee and stopped. He was not alone. Edward was above Lily Millington, his damp hair hanging over his face, while hers was spread glimmering on the velvet cushion. He wore nothing, and neither did she. Their skin was candle-lit, smooth, and they gazed at one another, the two of them locked within a moment that belonged to them alone. Lucy managed to withdraw from the room unseen. She fled back along the corridor and up the stairs to her bedroom, where she threw herself onto her bed. She wanted to disappear, to explode like a star into tiny, tiny pieces of dust that burned up and became nothing. She didn't understand what she was feeling, why she was hurting this way. Tears fell, and she hugged her pillow to her chest. She was embarrassed, she realized. Not for them, for they had been beautiful. No, Lucy was embarrassed for herself. She knew herself suddenly to be a child, an awkward, clomping girl who was neither beautiful nor desirable, who was clever, certainly, but otherwise ordinary, who was, she saw clearly now, not the first and most special person to anyone. The way that Edward had looked at Lily Millington, the way that they had looked at one another. He would never look at Lucy like that, and neither should he, neither would she want him to. And yet at the same time, as she pictured his expression, Lucy felt something inside her that had been carefully constructed and important crumble and fall away. Because she understood that the time of being children together, brother and sister, was over, and that they were each standing on different sides of a river now. Lucy was woken by a tremendous noise, and her first thought was that the storm had returned to rage on for another day. When she cracked her eyes open, though, light spilled in, and she saw that it was a bright and brilliant morning. She noticed, too, that she was curled up in a tangle of sheets at the foot of her bed. The noise came again, and Lucy realized it was Thurston shooting at the birds. Events of the previous day came rushing back upon her. Lucy had a headache. It happened sometimes when she hadn't slept for long enough, and now she went downstairs to fetch a glass of water. She had hoped to find Emma in the kitchen and to sink down into the woven chair by the cooker, from which she would listen as the maid told mild stories of local happenings and tut-tutted good-naturedly about the louche behaviour of the others. But Emma wasn't there. The kitchen was empty and showed no sign that anyone had been in it since Lucy and Lily Millington had made cheese sandwiches the night before. The night before. Lucy shook her head in an attempt to rid herself of the confusion of what she had seen in Edward's studio. It certainly provided an explanation as to the conversation she'd overheard between Edward and Thurston. So, too, Edward's preference that Fanny Brown not come to Birchwood Manor for the summer. But what did it all mean? What was going to happen? She filled a glass with water, and when she noticed a line of light creeping across the tiles from beneath the back door, decided to take it outside with her. Everything was better beneath the big blue sky, and Lucy walked barefooted across the dew-damp grass. When she reached the corner of the house, she closed her eyes and tilted her face towards the morning sun. It was only 9 o'clock, but already it held the promise of heat to come.
"Good morning, little Radcliffe."
Lucy opened her eyes and saw Thurston sitting on Edward's iron peacock chair, smiling around his cigarette.
"Come and sit with Uncle Thurston. I might even let you hold my rifle if you're a very good girl."
Lucy shook her head and stayed where she was. He laughed, lifting the weapon to take casual aim at a sparrow that had alit briefly on the wisteria arbor. He mimed pulling the trigger.
"You shouldn't shoot the birds."
"There are many things in life one shouldn't do, Lucy, and they're usually the things one most enjoys."
He lowered the weapon.
"Big day ahead for you."
Lucy did not know what he meant, but did not wish to give him the pleasure of hearing her say so. Instead, she eyed him coolly and waited for him to continue.
"Bet you didn't imagine you'd be modelling this summer."
With everything that had happened since, Lucy had forgotten Felix's suggestion of the night before, his determination to make a photographic plate based on the tale of the Eldritch children.
"Little Lucy, the stunner. Have you been practicing your poses?"
"No."
"Good girl. Natural is better. I've tried to tell Claire, the most beautiful people are those who don't care enough to try."
"Is Felix planning to take the photograph today?"
"There was much excited talk of capturing light earlier."
"Where are the others?"
Thurston stood up and used the barrel of his rifle to indicate towards the attic.
Raking through the costume chest.
He tucked the weapon under his arm and brushed past Lucy on his way towards the kitchen. Emma's not in there.
So I heard.
Lucy wondered what else he'd heard. She called after him.
Do you know where she is?
Ill, at home in bed. A messenger came this morning, someone from the village. She won't be in today, and we are all to fend for ourselves.
Lucy found the others in the attic, where, just as Thurston had said, they were busy pulling costumes from the large trunk, trying on flowing dresses, cinching them with ribbons at the waist, and talking animatedly about how best to weave garlands for their hair. The novelty of her inclusion made Lucy shy, and she hovered in the corner near the top of the stairs as she waited to be invited closer.
"We should make sure that they match,"
Claire was saying to Adele. "But not exactly. Each of the Eldritch children would have a different type of magic."
"Would they?"
"We could show it through the use of different flowers. I'll be a rose, you can be a honeysuckle."
"And Lucy?"
"Whatever she likes. I don't know. A daisy, perhaps? Something befitting, don't you think, darling?"
"Yes, yes, wonderful."
Felix, only half listening, was nonetheless ecstatic in his response. He was by the window, holding a piece of fine gauze up to the light, squinting first one eye and then the other as he considered its effect. Lily Millington, Lucy noticed, was not present. Neither was Fanny or Edward. Adele took Claire by the hand and together they brushed past Lucy's corner in a giddy rush.
"Come on, slow coach,"
Claire called back from halfway down the stairs.
"You need to make a garland too."
Some of the roses were a little the worse for wear after the previous night's rain, their delicate petals littering the grass, but there had been such an abundance to start with that the garland makers were still spoiled for choice. Along the stone wall that bordered the orchard were a number of daisy bushes, and Lucy picked a selection of the pink, white and yellow flowers, keeping the stems long enough that she was able to sit upon a dry patch of grass afterwards and braid them together. The garland would not keep for long, but Lucy was happy with her progress. She couldn't think that she had ever made such a thing before, and in any other context, she would have thought the occupation a frivolous waste of time. But this was different. Lucy had been uncertain about being part of Felix's photograph. Now she realised that she was starting to feel excited. She would never have admitted it to anyone else. She wasn't even able to explain the feeling properly to herself. But being part of the photograph made Lucy feel more like a real person than she had before. Lily Millington had joined them in the garden and was sitting quietly to weave her own garland. Lucy, stealing glances from where she was sitting cross-legged by the daisy bush, noticed that a slight frown pulled at her brows. Thurston, too, had gathered his sketchbook and pens and was now helping Felix to assemble the glass plates and collodion, ready to carry them with the camera and tent to the woods. Only Edward and Fanny were missing, and Lucy wondered whether they were having the talk that Edward had promised as he shepherded her up to bed the night before. Felix said that the light would be best in the middle of the day, when the sun was at its strongest and everything was geared towards his decree. For the rest of her life, Lucy would remember the way the others looked, dressed in their garlands and costumes as they made their way through the long meadow grasses towards the woods. Sprays of wildflowers peppered the grass and rustled when the light breeze blew warmly across their tops. They had passed the barn, with the threshing machine inside it, and had almost made it as far as the river, when the cry came from behind them.
"Wait for me, I want to be in the photograph!"
They turned around and saw Fanny stalking towards them. Edward was close on her heels, a stormy look upon his face.
"I want to be in the photograph,"
she said again, drawing near.
"I want to be the Fairy Queen."
Felix, the wooden tripod balanced on his shoulder, shook his head, confused.
"I need Lily as the Fairy Queen. It has to be the same as Edward's painting. I want them to stand as companion pieces. How better to demonstrate that photography and painting are on a level? But Fanny can be one of the princesses."
We're engaged to be married, Edward. I should be the fairy queen from your story.
Lily glanced at Edward. Of course she should.
I didn't ask you to speak, said Fanny with a curl of her lip. You're paid to stand there and look vacant. I was talking to my fiancé.
Fanny, said Edward, a note of controlled caution in his voice. I told you.
I'm going to lose the perfect light, said Felix with some desperation. I need Lily as the queen, but Fanny, you can be the frontmost child. Claire and Adele, one either side.
But Felix...
Adele, that's enough, the light.
Lucy, said Claire,
give your garland to Fanny so that we can get started.
Within a fraction of a second, Lucy took in the faces of Claire, Edward, Lily Millington, Felix and Fanny, all now staring straight at her. And then, without a word, she started to run.
Lucy, wait!
But Lucy didn't wait. She tossed her garland to the ground and kept running like a little girl all the way back towards the house. Lucy did not go to her bedroom or to the library or to the kitchen where she could have had her way with the remaining half of the Victoria sponge that Emma had baked on Friday. Instead, she went to Edward's studio in the Mulberry Room. Even as she pushed open the door, she was uncertain as to why she had come, only that it had somehow seemed the only place to go. Lucy was fast learning that she knew a lot less about her own motivations than she did about the way the internal combustion engine worked. Having arrived, she found herself at a loss. She was out of breath from running and embarrassed for fleeing. She felt rejected, but at the same time cross with herself for having let the others see her disappointment. And she was tired, very tired. There had been so much excitement and such a lot to comprehend. When no better option came to mind, she sank to the ground in self-pity and curled up like a cat. It was approximately 2.5 minutes later that her gaze, which had been sweeping generally across the floor of the room, fell upon Edward's leather satchel, leaning against the leg of his easel. The satchel was new. Lily Millington had given it to him for his birthday, and Lucy had been envious when she saw how much he loved it. She had been confused too, for never before had a model given Edward a gift, let alone a fine, prized gift. She understood more clearly now, after what she'd seen last night. Lucy decided that she no longer had the necessary commitment required for self-pity. The urge had been replaced by another, stronger impulse, curiosity. She righted herself and went to pick up the satchel. Lucy undid the buckle and flipped it open. She could see Edward's current sketch pad and his wooden pen holder, and with them, something else, something less expected. It was a black velvet box of the same sort that Mother kept on her dressing table in Hampstead to safeguard the pearls and brooches that Father had given her. She slid the box out of the satchel and with a shiver of nerves lifted the lid. The first thing she saw were two pieces of paper. They had been folded together, but opened in the space created when the lid lifted. They were Cunard tickets for a Mr. and Mrs. Radcliffe travelling to New York City on the 1st of August. Lucy was still considering the implications of this discovery when the tickets fell to the ground. As soon as she saw the large blue gem beneath, Lucy knew that she had expected all along to find the Radcliffe blue within the jeweller's box. Edward hadn't imagined the diamond onto Lily Millington's neck. He had taken it from the bank's safety deposit box. And without permission, she was sure, for there was no way Grandfather would have allowed such a terrifying breach of protocol. Lucy lifted the pendant from the box and held it in her palm, draping the fine chain over the top of her hand. She was shaking a little, she noticed. She glanced back at the painting of Lily Millington. Lucy was not the type of girl who longed for frills and lace and shiny gems, but over the past 2 weeks, she had become more aware than ever of the distance between herself and beauty. Now she took the necklace with her to the looking glass above the fireplace. She stared squarely for a moment at her small, plain face, and then, with a slight tightening of her lips, lifted the fine chain and attached it at the nape of her neck. The pendant, sitting cool against her skin, was heavier than she had imagined it would be. It was wondrous. Lucy turned her head this way and that, slowly, observing the way light caught the diamond's facets and threw flecks upon her skin. She inspected each of her profiles in turn, and then every position between, watching the lights dance. This, she thought, is what it is to be adorned. She smiled tentatively at the girl in the mirror. The girl smiled back. And then the girl's smile dropped. In the mirror behind her was Lily Millington. Lily Millington did not bat an eyelid. She neither admonished nor laughed. She merely said, "I've come on Felix's behalf. He insists that you must be in the photograph." Lucy did not turn around, but spoke instead to the mirror. "He doesn't need me, not with Fanny. There are four of you already." "No, there are four of you. I have decided against being in the photograph." "You're just trying to be kind." "I make a point of never trying to be kind." Lily Millington was before her now, and she looked closely at Lucy, frowning. "What on earth?" Lucy held her breath, waiting for what she knew must follow. Sure enough, Lily Millington reached out and brushed the side of her neck. "Well now, look at that," she said softly, unfurling her fingers to reveal another silver shilling in her palm. "I had a feeling you'd turn out to be a valuable friend." Lucy felt a sting of tears threaten. There was a part of her that wanted to hug Lily Millington. She reached up to unhook the necklace. "Did you think about whether you're going to tell me how it's done?" "It's all to do with this part of your hand here," said Lily Millington, pointing at the skin between her thumb and forefinger. "You have to hold the coin firmly, but be careful to keep it concealed." "How do you get the coin in there without being seen?" "Well, now, that's the art, isn't it?" They smiled at one another then, and a wave of understanding passed between them. "Now," said Lily Millington, "for the sake of Felix, who is becoming more frantic with each passing minute, I suggest that you get yourself down to the woods at once."
"My garland, I threw it."
"And I gathered it. It's hanging on the back doorknob." Lucy glanced down at the Radcliffe blue pendant, still in her hand.
"I should put this away."
"Yes," said Lily Millington. And then, when hurried footsteps sounded suddenly in the hallway, "Oh dear, Felix, I fear." But the man, when he arrived at the door to the Mulberry Room, was not Felix. It was a stranger, someone whom Lucy had never seen before. A man with brown hair and a wet smirk that set Lucy against him from the start.
"The front door was unlocked. I didn't think you'd mind."
"What are you doing here?" said Lily Millington in an anguished voice.
"Checking up on you, of course."
Lucy looked from one to the other, waiting for an introduction. The man was standing in front of Edward's painting now.
Very nice indeed. He's good, I'll give him that."
"You must go, Martin. The others will soon be back. If they find you here, it will likely cause a disturbance."
"Likely cause a disturbance?" he laughed. "Listen to the hoity-toity lady."
His mirthful expression dropped suddenly, and he said,
"Leave? I don't think so. Not without you."
He reached out to touch the canvas, and Lucy drew breath at the sacrilege.
"That's the blue. You were right. She's going to be very pleased. Very pleased indeed."
"I said a month."
"You did, but you're a fast worker. One of the best. Who can resist your charms?"
He nodded at the painting.
"Seems to me like you've got on ahead of time, sister dear."
Sister? Lucy remembered then the story of Edward meeting Lily Millington, the brother who had been with her at the theatre, the parents who had needed convincing that their daughter would not be risking her respectability if she were to pose for Edward's painting. Was this horrid man really Lily Millington's brother? Why then hadn't she said so? Why hadn't she introduced him to Lucy? And why was Lucy filled now with a sense of dread? The man noticed the tickets on the floor then and scooped them up.
America, eh? The land of new beginnings. I like the sound of that. Very clever. Very clever indeed. And a travel date so soon.
Run ahead, Lucy, said Lily Millington. Go and join the others. Hurry now, before anyone else comes up here looking for you. I don't want to. Lucy, please. There was an urgency to Lily Millington's tone, and reluctantly Lucy left the room. But she didn't go back to the woods. She stayed on the other side of the door and listened. Lily Millington's voice was soft, but Lucy could hear her saying, "More time. America. My father." The man burst out laughing and said something so quietly that Lucy couldn't hear. Lily Millington made a noise then, as if she had been hit and was winded, and Lucy was about to charge in to help when the door flew open and the man, Martin, swept past her, dragging Lily by the wrist behind him, muttering to her,
"Blue, America, new beginnings."
Lily Millington saw Lucy and shook her head, indicating that she should make herself scarce. But Lucy refused. She followed them down the hallway, and when they reached the drawing room and the man saw her, he laughed and said,
"Look out, here comes the cavalry, the little knight in shining armour."
"Lucy, please," said Lily Millington. "You must go."
"Best listen to her," the man grinned. "Little girls who don't know when to leave have a habit of coming to sticky ends."
"Please, Lucy." There was a look of fear in Lily's eyes, but Lucy was overcome, suddenly, with all the uncertainty of the past few days, the prevailing sense that she was too young to be of any use, that she didn't belong, that decisions were made above and around her but never to include her. And now, this man, whom she did not know, was trying to take Lily Millington away, and without understanding why, Lucy did not want that to happen, and she saw that this was her opportunity to put her foot down on a matter, any matter, that she cared about. She glimpsed Thurston's rifle lying on the chair where he'd left it after breakfast that morning, and in one fell swoop, she seized it, held it by the barrel, and whacked it as forcefully as she could against the sneering head of the awful stranger. His hand went to the side of his face in shock, and Lucy struck him again and then kicked him hard in the shins. He stumbled and then tripped over a table leg and fell to the ground. "Quick!" said Lucy, pulse drumming in her ears. "He'll be on his feet again soon. We have to hide." She took Lily Millington by the hand and led her halfway up the stairs. At the landing, she pushed aside the bent wood chair, and as Lily Millington watched, Lucy pressed the wooden rise to reveal the trap door. Even in that moment of fearful panic, Lucy managed to feel a jolt of pride at Lily Millington's surprise. "Quick," she said again. "He'll never find you in there."
"How did you..."
"Hurry! But you must come in too. He is not kind, Lucy. He is not a good man. He will hurt you, especially now that he's been bested." "There isn't room, but there's another one. I'll hide there."
"Is it far?"
Lucy shook her head. "Then get inside and don't hop out. Do you hear me? No matter what happens, Lucy, stay hidden. Stay safe until Edward comes to find you." Lucy promised that she would, and then sealed Lily Millington inside the chamber. Without wasting another moment, aware that the man was clambering to his feet in the drawing room below, she ran to the top of the stairs and along the hallway, sliding back the panel and climbing in. She sealed the door behind her, enclosing herself within the dark. Time passed differently in the hideaway. Lucy heard the man calling out for Lily Millington, and she heard other noises too, far away. But she wasn't frightened. Her eyes had begun to adjust, and at some point Lucy had noticed that she wasn't alone, and that it wasn't truly dark at all. There were thousands of little lights, the size of pinpricks twinkling at her from within the fibre of the wooden boards. As she sat, waiting, hugging her knees to her chest, Lucy felt strangely safe in her secret hiding place, and she wondered whether Edward's fairy story might have had some truth to it after all. 10. I still hear his voice sometimes, that whisper in my ear. I still remember the smell of cheese and tobacco from his lunch.
Your father isn't in America, Birdie. He never was. He was trampled by a horse the day you were supposed to sail. It was Jeremiah that brought you to us. Scooped you off the ground while you were sickly. Left your dad for the poorhouse to bury. And brought you to my ma. Your lucky day it was. Jeremiah's lucky day too, for he's been on a very good wicket ever since. He said that you were a bright little thing, and you've done very well for him, you have. You didn't really think he was sending all those spoils across the ocean, did you?
He could not have winded me more surely had he driven his knee hard into my chest. And yet, I did not question what he told me. I did not doubt his claim, not even for a second, for I knew as soon as he said it that it was true. It was the only thing that made sense, and everything in my life to date was suddenly brought into sharper focus. Why else would my father fail to send for me? It had been 11 years since I had woken up in the room above the shop selling birds in cages, surrounded by Mrs. Mack and the others. My father was dead. He had been dead all along. Martin grabbed my wrist then and started pulling me towards the door of the Mulberry Room. He was whispering that it was going to be all right, that he would make it all right, that I wasn't to be sad because he had an idea. We would take the blue, he and I, and instead of delivering it back to London, we would take it ourselves, the diamond and the ticket too, and sail to America. It was the land of new beginnings after all, just like it said in the letters that Jeremiah brought for me each month. He meant, of course, the letters that Mrs. Mack used to read out loud, the news from America, the news from my father, all of it made up. It was a breathtaking deception. But what moral platform did I have from which to beat my breast? I was a petty thief, a pretender, a woman who had taken on an assumed name without a blink of hesitation. Why, I had deceived Mrs. Mack little more than a fortnight ago, when I told her of my intention to go away with Edward to the country. Mrs. Mack would never have let me go away willingly, not to Birchwood Manor for the summer, and not to America with Edward. Over the years, I had become her most reliable earner, and in my short life, there was one thing I had learned for certain. People become used to riches quickly, and even if they've done nothing themselves to earn the wealth, once it's been had, they consider it their due. Mrs. Mack believed that she was entitled to everything that I was and that I had, and so, in order that I might leave London with Edward, I told her it was all part of a scheme. I told her that within a month I would return with riches the likes of which they'd never seen. "What sort of riches?" said Mrs. Mack, never one for generalities. And because the best deceptions always skirt the truth, I told them about Edward's plans to paint me and his idea to include the priceless Radcliffe blue. It was dark in the chamber and very hard to breathe. It was eerily quiet. I thought about Edward and wondered what was happening with Fanny down by the woods. I thought about Pale Joe and the letter I had sent him from the village telling him that I was going to America, that he might not hear from me for some time, but he was not to worry. And I thought about the photograph that I had enclosed for him, to remember me by, the photograph that Edward had taken with Felix's camera. I thought of my father and the weight of his hand around mine, the supreme happiness I had felt when I was tiny and we set out together on our railway journeys to visit a broken clock. And I thought of my mother, who was like sunlight on the surface of my memories, bright and warm, but shifting. I remembered being with her one day at the edge of the river that ran behind our house in London. I had dropped a scrap of ribbon I'd been treasuring and was forced to watch helpless as the current took it away. I had cried, but my mother had explained to me that it was the nature of the river. The river, she said, is the greatest collector of them all, ancient and indiscriminate, carrying its load on a one-way journey towards the depthless sea. "The river owes you no kindness, little bird," she said, "so you must be careful." I realized that I could hear the river in that pitch-black hole, that I could feel its currents lulling me to sleep. And then I heard something else. A set of footprints, heavy on the floorboards above,
and a muffled voice.
I have the tickets.
It was Martin, right above the trap door.
Where have you got to? We just need the blue and then we can get out of here.
And then there came another noise, a door slamming downstairs, and I knew that someone else was in the house. Martin ran towards the interruption, raised voices, a scream, and then a gunshot. Moments later, more shouting, Edward calling out. I felt about for a latch to release the trapdoor, but no matter where my fingers traced, I could not find one. I could not sit up. I could not turn around. I began to grow frightened. And the more I panicked, the shorter my breaths became, the harder they stuck against the back of my throat. I tried to answer, but my voice was little more than a whisper. It was hot, so hot. Edward called out again. He called for me, his voice sharpened with fear. He called for Lucy. He sounded a long way away. Rapid footprints overhead, lighter than Martin's, coming from the hallway upstairs, and then a tremendous thump that made the floorboards rattle. Mayhem, but not for me. I was a boat on a gentle tide, the river shifting softly beneath me, and as I closed my eyes, another memory came. I was a baby, not yet a year old, lying in a crib in an upstairs room of the little house by the river in Fulham. A warm breeze wafted through the window and brought with it the sounds of morning birds and the secretive smells of lilac and mud. Light was turning circles on the ceiling, in step with the shadows, and I was watching them dance. I reached up to clutch at them, but they slipped through my fingers every time. Chapter 27. Spring 1882.
A nice old place, been a bit neglected inside, but good bones. Let me just get the door open and you can see for yourself what I mean.
Lucy did not do herself or Edward's lawyer the discourtesy of pretending that she had never been inside Birchwood Manor, neither did she volunteer the fact. She said nothing and waited instead for the man to jiggle the key in the lock. It was a morning in early spring and the air was crisp. Someone had been maintaining the garden, not perfectly, but with sufficient care to stop the tendrils overgrowing the paths. The honeysuckle had a promising layer of buds, and the first jasmine flowers along the wall and around the kitchen window were starting to open. They were late. The laneways of London were already perfumed, but then, as Edward used to say, the city plants were always more precocious than their country cousins.
There she goes, said Mr. Matthews of Holbert Matthews and Sons, as the lock gave way with a deep, gratifying clunk. That's got it now.
The door swung open and Lucy felt a roiling sensation deep within the pit of her stomach. After 20 years of absence, of wandering, of trying not to wander, the moment was finally upon her. She had received the letter 5 months before, only days after news of Edward's death in Portugal had finally reached them. She had spent the morning at the museum in Bloomsbury, where she had volunteered to help catalogue the donated collections, and had been home only long enough to sit down to a pot of tea when her maid, Jane, brought in the afternoon post. The letter, written on gold-embossed letterhead, had begun by expressing the writer's deepest sympathies for her loss, before moving on to notify her in the second paragraph that she had been named as a beneficiary in the last will and testament of her brother, Edward Julius Radcliffe. In closing, the letter's writer had invited Miss Radcliffe to make an appointment at their offices to discuss the matter further. Lucy had read the letter again and again, tripped over the words, "Your brother, Edward Julius Radcliffe." Your brother. She wondered whether there were many beneficiaries who needed reminding of their relationship to the deceased. Lucy had not needed a reminder. While it had been many years since she had seen Edward, and then only a very brief and unsatisfactory meeting in a dingy building in Paris, reminders of him were everywhere. His paintings covered almost every wall of the house. Mother insisted that none should be removed, holding out hope to the last that he would return and take up where he'd left off, that perhaps it was not too late for him to make a name for himself, as Thurston Holmes and Felix Bernard had done. And so the beautiful faces of Adele and Fanny and Lily Millington stared down at Lucy, in repose, in consideration, in character, watching her every move as she tried to get on. Those eyes that followed a person. Lucy was always careful not to meet them. When she received the letter from Messrs. Holbert and Matthews, Lucy had written back by return post to make an appointment to meet at noon that Friday, and as the first flurry of December snow fell lightly outside the window, she found herself sitting on one side of a large sombre desk in the Mayfair office of Mr. Matthews Sr., listening as the old lawyer told her that Birchwood Manor,
a farmhouse in a little village near Letchley-on-Thames,
was now hers. When the meeting was at a close, he sent her home to Hampstead with a direction that she must let them know when she wished to visit the house so that he could arrange for his son to accompany her to Berkshire. Lucy, with no intention then of visiting Berkshire, had told him that it was far too much to ask. But it was
all part of the service, Miss Radcliffe,
Mr. Matthews had said, indicating a large wooden panel on the wall behind him, on which in gold cursive lettering was painted, Holbert Matthews and Sons, carrying out the wishes of our clients in death as indeed in life. Lucy had left the office, her thoughts in an uncharacteristic swirl. Birchwood Manor. What a generous gift. What a double-edged sword. In the days and weeks that followed, when the nights were at their blackest, Lucy had wondered whether Edward had left her the house because on some level, due perhaps to the deep connection they once shared, he had guessed. But no, Lucy was too rational to let such an illogical idea take root. For one thing, there was nothing certain to guess. Even Lucy did not know for sure. For another, Edward's thinking had been clear. He had specified within a handwritten letter attached to his will that the house should be used by Lucy to build a school offering education to girls as bright as she had been. Girls who quested for the type of knowledge that was otherwise denied them. And just as Edward had possessed a gift in life that enabled him to win people over to his way of thinking, in death too, his words had influence. For although, in the offices of Holbert Matthews and Sons, Lucy had promised herself that she would sell the house, that she would never again willingly set foot within its walls, almost immediately upon leaving, Edward's vision seeped into her thoughts and began weakening her better judgment. Lucy had walked north through Regent's Park, and her gaze had alit upon one little girl after another, each obedient beside her nanny, and longing, surely, to do more, to see more, to know more than she was currently permitted. Lucy had a vision of herself shepherding a clutch of pink-cheeked girls with questing spirits and excited voices, girls who did not fit within the moulds that had been ascribed to them, who longed to learn and improve and grow. Over the coming weeks, she thought of little else. She became obsessed with the idea that everything in her life had led her to this point, that there was nothing more right than that she should open a school in the twin-gabled house on the bend of the river. And so here she was. It had taken 5 months to reach this point, but she was ready. "Do I need to sign something?" she said as the lawyer led her into the kitchen, where the square pine table was still in place. Lucy half expected to see Emma Stearns coming through the parlour door, shaking her head in bemusement at whatever strange behaviour she'd witnessed on the other side. The lawyer looked surprised.
"What sort of thing?"
"I'm not certain. I've never been given a house before. I presume there is a deed of title."
"There is nothing to sign, Miss Radcliffe. The deed, as it were, is done. The papers have been finalised. The house is yours."
"Well, then." Lucy held out her hand. "I thank you, Mr. Matthews. It has been a pleasure to meet you."
"But, Miss Radcliffe, would you not like me to show you the property?"
"It won't be necessary, Mr. Matthews."
"But having come all this way,
I trust that I am able to stay behind today.
Well, yes, as I said, the house is yours.
Then thank you kindly for accompanying me, Mr. Matthews. Now, if you will excuse me, I have much to get on with. There is going to be a school, did you hear? I am going to open a school for promising young ladies. But Lucy did not get on at once with preparations for the school. There was something more pressing that she had to do first, a task as awful as it was essential. For 5 months she had turned it over in her mind, longer than that, to be honest.